What if you didn't need $1 million to retire early? Instead, just enough to buy back your time? What if financial freedom looked less like yachts and Lamborghinis and more like flying to Lisbon on a Tuesday, working when you feel like it, and saying yes to life whenever it calls? Now, that's the promise of Barista Fire. It's exactly what today's guest is doing. Welcome to Making Sense. It's the podcast for people who want financial freedom without giving up their coffee, supported by our friends at KiwiBank. I'm Frances Cook, an independent financial journalist and fellow financial freedom seeker who makes money simple for you. So what is Barista Fire? It's when you save and invest just enough to cover most of your living costs, probably not all of them. And then you fill the gap with part-time or casual work that you choose. Something fun, something flexible. So you're not stuck in a job that you hate for decades. You get the freedom now. Today's guest, Germano Gomez, made it happen. He paid off his mortgage in 5 years, kept his lifestyle lean, and stacked up savings fast. Now, he travels the world. He picks up work when he wants to, skips it when he doesn't. It's financial freedom on his terms. So, how much did it take? What sacrifices did he make? And could it work for you? Let's find out. Making Sense is on a mission to make money simple, and I just couldn't do that without the support of KiwiBank. It's really important to me to only work with companies that understand that mission. And for KiwiBank, their purpose is to help Kiwi and Aotearoa be better off. So bringing you real stories of different approaches to finance is one of the ways they're making a difference to the lives of their customers. This is making Kiwi better off. This is Kiwi. All right, joined now by Germano Gomez, and you have used financial independence to build up this really flexible lifestyle that I think a lot of people would envy. You only work part of the year. Tell me what that looks like at this point in life for you. How much do you work? How much do you get to play these days?
These days, I tend to work about half of the year and play about half of the year. Give or take, it really depends. Like, you know, this summer I took on a full-time job for 6 months and, you know, I enjoyed it. When I first started, I was working on average about 23, 24 hours a week over the years, but sometimes I would take 4 months off. Sometimes I would work full-time. Really varies. Depends on the year. Depends if I have somewhere I want to be or something I want to do. Then it kind of, I'll travel more. And then, you know, if I need more money for my trips, then I'll work a little bit more to make that up.
How long did it take you to get here? Because you say it took a while. What type of work did you do to be able to build up this sort of flexibility? I suppose it's not just the work you did, it's also been your money strategy, right? So talk me through a little bit of the journey it's been to get here.
I mean, going back to the very beginning, I mean, when I first kind of settled in New Zealand and I got my residency and everything after I had done some travels and stuff, yeah, like me and my partner back then, we bought a house and we were able to pay it off like in about 5 years or so. Bearing in mind that mortgages back then were much, much lower value. Like, you know, they were like in the high 100,000s, 200,000 tops. So it's not like the crazy money that we're talking these days. So of course that makes it much easier. But I was working in the dairy industry. I was working in production, but it kind of took me about maybe 6-7 years to start the wheels in motion to having paid off my house, to end up buying a rental property and then having two houses for about 2 years. And then I realized that's not the way I wanted to go. And then once I had the mortgage and I built up some FU money and some, you know, like build up a bit of a buffer, then I was able to start basically negotiating my hours a little bit more aggressively, if you want to put it that way, because the conversation changed when you have your buffer, when you have your backup money. You can just, you know, you just go and ask for things you want. It just makes it easier. And then if you, you know, if they tell you no, then you go look for it somewhere else.
Yeah. Well, exactly. Because you were someone who, even in those quite early days, and I know real estate is a tricky one. A lot of the prices now are so high that people struggle with it. But
when you bought your first house, you were really, really focused on getting it paid off fast, faster than a lot of people do it, right? And that was quite a key strategy to you building up this financial independence and lifestyle flexibility, right?
Yes, it was. And I have to say, like, I was very, very lucky because I had a partner who trusted me and trusted my numbers. And back then, like, we were looking at renting. And when I run the numbers, it was just cheaper for us to buy than to rent. You know, that first 5 years, that first 3-4 years when your interest rates are at the highest, that's when you have to pretty much concentrate it on. You have to put everything into it. The first few years are critical. And, you know, we were doing that. And we were almost done after a few years because we just went really, really hard. And I don't feel we deprived ourselves from doing what we wanted. We still traveled. We still enjoyed our time off and we still did whatever we wanted to do.
Yeah. Because that first house, you got paid off roughly 5 years. Is that right? Did you have any particular strategies on paying that off?
Just put as much as you can, as fast as you can. Because I know I'm good at saving money. So I remember we had a portion of it on floating because that way that enabled us to pay that little portion much faster than the rest of the mortgage. And we fixed, I think it was 3 years, we fixed. So we knew exactly how much was coming down. And then the floating portion, yeah, we just pretty much concentrated on clearing that up without giving ourselves that buffer, of course, you know, like to... For emergencies, for travel, for anything that came up, we had that little buffer there for us. And we were lucky we didn't need it.
What about, you know, the idea of financial independence? I think it can be really motivating for people when they find out about that and find out that there's this whole idea of, you know, building up your financial reserves and using it to build the life that you want. And yet it sounds like you were actually building towards that before you even knew what financial independence was. So when did you find out about the idea of financial independence and what appealed to you about the idea?
Through this book here, you know, good old Tim Ferriss, 4-Hour Work Week. This book, I can say, changed my life. Not for the book itself, because I never really done anything the book says to do, but it just opened up. It just changed my way of thinking about things and also cemented some of the ideas I already had. It started naming things that I was already doing that I didn't even know were a thing. But for me, financial independence has always been about flexibility and freedom, just being in control of my own time.
What I love about that as well is that you have shortcutted that quite significantly. You are someone who has heard about the financial independence movement and said, okay, what I want is freedom of time. You've built your version of financial independence quite quickly in a way where you can still bring in money. You still work. You're not one of those people who's got like millions invested and just live off that on a private island somewhere. You are still working flexibly, but on the way that works for you. And I think that's so much more achievable for the average person to do, to have work in the mix, but on their terms. How did you hit on that? How much thinking did you have to do to be like, actually, this is the version of life that I think I would enjoy?
It was a lot of trial and error, of course. But I think is when I came across like this little phrase, that little quote that say, enough is not a number, it's a decision.
Yeah.
So you have to make that decision. You know, what's enough? How much is enough? And what's enough for me is not enough for you. You know, it's that number is different for everybody. You know, as much as I enjoyed the work I was doing, you know, it was tying me down. I wanted to travel longer and I wanted to do other things. But I, you know, I don't want to just sit in the house and do nothing. I want to still keep occupied. So yeah, like sometimes if you can get a job that pays way less, but then you're happier if you have a little bit of a buffer. Like, you know, I mean, I live a simple life, so I don't need a lot. So that makes it easier, of course. You know, like my car is 11 years old. My computer is 11 years old. So yeah, so it's one of those things. They both need changing, by the way. They both need upgrading, but it will come with time.
You clearly know what matters to you though, right? Talk to me about your lifestyle now. You know, how frugal is it in order to make this work? What will you spend on? What won't you spend on?
For example, I don't value like eating out. For example, like I don't, doesn't appeal to me. I prefer to, you know, to buy my own leg of lamb and just roast it and have it in the house, you know, like just cook it myself. But in the other hand, I will drop $2,000 in a plane ticket without even thinking about it. Like I will save on the $5 coffee, but then I will spend $2,000 on a plane ticket. I've joined a hiking club. You know, the other day we went on this hike and it cost $60 because there was a boat trip involved and it was, you know, we had to go across the lake and everything. And I paid $60 without even thinking about it. But in the other hand, you know, if I go out in the city, sometimes I want a coffee and I won't buy it because I think, oh no, $5 is too much. I'm not going to spend it. I will just have that coffee when I get home. Like I was telling you before, when I built that buffer, when I built that, you know, FU money, if you want to call it, I saved basically a year's worth of my income. And then I figured out that I could actually live on that money for about 4 or 5 years. When I thought I had 1 year's saved up, in fact, I had like 4 years to live off, even if I didn't work at all. And then when you start working for, say, minimum wage or very low income, much lower than what I was on, that money just stretches out, you know, probably, I don't know, 10 years or so. If I'm frugal enough, if I keep, you know, being simple enough.
Talk to me about this FU money, because living frugally, living within your means, all great. That gives you money to do something with, then you do something with it, right? To build up this buffer. So what did you do? Save, invest, property, shares? What did you do with that money that you were looking to put to work?
My ex-partner and I, at the time, we bought a house. And then when we went our separate ways, she bought me out. And then I used that money to put in a deposit. So I bought a house so I had a place to live. And then I concentrated on paying their mortgage off. And then I went to Australia for a couple of years and then I rented that house. And when I came back from Australia, I was going to basically move back into the house. But then, I was looking into rental properties and all of that kind of stuff. So I ended up buying another house and I was flatting. So I had I was in a flat and I had two houses and then I started managing my rental myself. And then I ended up moving into the other house. And when my tenants left, then I made a decision to basically sell that and clear the mortgage. And then I had some change. And then that change became my FU money. And back then I just put it on a term deposit because I didn't really know what to do with it.
And you did at one point, as you've mentioned, get into investment property. You decided that wasn't for you in the end. Talk to me about that, on whether that was important to your financial strategy and why you decided actually, no, it's not working for me. What wasn't working?
Well, as they say, hindsight's a beautiful thing. Like if you asked me at the time, I decided not to, you know, not to to sell my rental and everything. If I'd sold it probably a year later, I would have probably made $100,000 more on the sale. And if I'd stuck with it for probably another 5 years, you know, it would have been probably $200,000-$400,000 more. I don't know. You know, when you look at the yields were just not good enough. I didn't consider the capital gain and all of that kind of stuff. So what I was making having a tenant in my house, I was pretty much making the same on a term deposit without all the hassle. And for me, something that's really important for me is peace. So I've always wanted peace in my life. So I don't want to have to deal with a lot of things. And I had great tenants. I had a really nice couple. They came from Australia to do a project in Hamilton. And they were there. They told me, look, we'll be here for 3 years. I had a property manager when I went to Aussie. When I came back, I managed it myself for another year, year and a half. I don't remember exactly. And they were great. But once they moved out, that's when I reevaluated everything.
This is the thing. I think a lot of people, and I mean, property investment can often be sold, as you see a lot of those seminars that they charge you money to attend, where they say, you know, get rich through property and it can be this amazing passive investment, yada, yada, yada. And property can be an amazing investment. I think it can stack up really well, but I would never call it passive. I just think it's very, very rare to find property that works passively. And even if it does for a while, often something will happen and it's not passive anymore. You've got to get on with it and get your hands in there. It's like you say, if someone like you who valued the flexibility, valued your peace, it often doesn't work, right?
No, it doesn't. But, and also like, I hate debt. Yeah. I mean, I don't like it. Honestly, at that time, 5 years in, probably one house would pay the mortgage off easily, but you don't know those things. I just couldn't sleep if I had $1 million mortgage. So I prefer to just pay my house off and just get that out of my shoulders, you know, get that off my back. Yeah, and I agree with you. It's definitely not passive. And then you have property managers and they charge a fee, and then you have mortgage interest rates, and then that's money that you're spending. So sometimes your house might double in value. But if you've spent half of it in interest to the banks, then, you know, your profit's actually not that great. So you've got to run your numbers.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Check the numbers. I think even when I talk to people who are keen on property, a lot of them will very freely say, you know, property can be amazing, but the average house is not necessarily a good property investment. Always, always run the numbers, even if you are keen on it. So, okay, let's keep pulling on the hot topics and say property versus shares, because I know people love to debate this one. What about yourself? Does that mean that you've ended up going more towards shares? Are you a fan of those?
I took the big dip that the market had during COVID, and then I thought that would be a great time to get in. And I did, and it was a great time to get in, but I didn't know a lot about it. So, yeah, it is good. Is it bad? I don't know. Like I said, if I kept my house, I'll probably be better off having had a property. But that was back. That's past. And with the shares, after my first year that I put some money there, I was probably up by like 40% or something when I looked. But today, if I was to sell my whole portfolio, I'll probably take a 30% loss because I did not know what I was doing. And I was picking shares myself. You know, I didn't know a lot of things. I was going on gut. That's not the very good way of doing it. But I haven't sold anything. So I don't know. Have I taken a loss? I don't know yet. That's to be advised. That's TBA.
Okay. So to sort of sum up how you handle the money side of it now, and then we're going to move on to lifestyle, because I just love the lifestyle that you've built for yourself. Am I right in saying that you've basically used the FU money that you've built up? You've made sure that you're debt-free, living this quite simple, quite frugal life. You've got some stashed in savings, some stashed in shares, and then you can use that to be able to you still work, but only part of the year and on your terms. And you've got that financial buffer to keep living your life flexibly. Is that a fair summary? Is there anything you'd change in there?
No, that's pretty accurate. Yeah, like, but these days, because I don't know when I'm going to be working and how long I'm going to be working for, I went towards dividend paying shares, because then I get that little trickling of money coming in. So that's basically has been my choice. My main concern was basically to have enough passive income that would pay off my bills. So if I was just sitting in my house, never go out, never do anything, just go to the supermarket, buy food and come back home and be able to pay my power bill and my rates, that's all I wanted. And, you know, I'm pretty much there now. So everything, all the work that I do has become play money.
Yeah. And on that, I mean, the lifestyle you've built, it's amazing. You do a lot of travel. You've also built in this, what I think is a very smart little travel hack. You do a lot of volunteering for huge sports events as well. So talk to me about that. You've been part of some really big tournaments, right?
Yes, I have. It all started in good old Hamilton, because they had the under-17 Women's World Cup. FIFA was 2008. That was my first ever event. And and I was a driver on that event, and I absolutely love it. So I started looking at, you know, just going overseas. Like I was lucky last year we had the Euro in Germany, and I have a cousin who lives in Germany. So I was in Germany for a month last year volunteering at the Euro. Yeah, so I did a tennis tournament in Australia, and I'm looking at going to do a volleyball tournament in Adelaide later in this year. So I'm already looking forward to that one. If there are places I haven't been, so I make a trip out of a volunteering event.
What's it like volunteering for these tournaments? Is it hard to get accepted to be part of the crew? And actually, do you even get to watch much of the games? Or are you quite busy with all the volunteering aspects?
Depends on the day and depends on the role. The Women's World Cup, for the first three matches, I was driving the referees to the match. So I got to watch all the matches on those particular days. And then the other two matches that we had, I was doing other things during the match, so I wasn't able to. So it really depends where you are, which role you get. And yeah, and as for getting in, like, I mean, for me, it's easy now because I've basically become a professional volunteer. But having said that, last year when I went to Germany, I also applied to be at the Champions League final in Wembley. And yeah, and then I missed out. I booked a hostel two stations out of Wembley Stadium. I booked my flights to go to London. But it turns out I was not accepted on the Champions League final. So I had 8 days in London just enjoying the city. I hadn't been to London in 22 years, so it was good to go back and see the old places again.
Should kids earn their pocket money or just get it? Julia from our friends at Kiwi Bank joins us to settle the debate and shares smart ways to teach kids about money. Catch the episode from 17 July. The Pocket Money Debate. Should kids earn it or just get it? This is Making Kiwi Better Off. This is Kiwi. Yeah, it strikes me as one of those things that, I mean, obviously the tickets to some of those events can be insane. So if you really want to see behind the scenes on those games, then maybe great. But it's also a very different way to get under the skin and have a different experience. I mean, I've said that sometimes before about, you know, traveling as a journalist, that I would get to go to places that you can't normally just get into, and you talk to people that you can't normally talk to. Is that part of the appeal as well, to really get under the skin if you're a bit sports mad, to also, you know, see how the sausage is made?
Oh, of course. Like I mean, with the Hamilton Sevens, like I was a liaison officer for the teams, and you know, you run into the pitch with them. You sit on the little in the dugout. I volunteered at a Black Caps match in Saddam Park in Hamilton, and I was holding the screen behind Ross Clark. You know, he'd just been elected man of the match, and I was actually holding the screen of all the sponsors. I was standing there. I was behind him as he was being interviewed. So, you know, you have those little stories. You definitely have to get to be in the thick of the action. And yeah, you definitely see things people normally don't see.
Yeah. And the rest of it as well. You are someone who has a big priority on travel, right? So what are some cool places you've traveled? And is there any that you would recommend or not recommend?
I like hiking as well. So I've walked across Switzerland a few years ago. And you look at the map and you see, oh, it's going to take about 20 days and I can book for 30 days. I give myself a buffer if something happens. You know, I've walked across Spain. I've done the Camino. You know, I booked 40 days to do the Camino and I only needed 30. So I had 6 days in Portugal afterwards to, you know, to enjoy and see the place. So, you know, I like to travel with a bit of a purpose, and I'm able to travel a lot because I travel on the cheap. And I travel off season, and I travel usually on my own because I can't find people with the same amount of time. So and that's the other thing I want to talk about, the financial side of things. Like, you know, some people see, you know, oh, you travel a lot, you travel, but like I spent 2 months in Europe and I spent the same as a couple of friends spent in 2 weeks.
What are some of your good travel hacks then? Because like you say, you spent the same in 2 months that some friends spent in 2 weeks. You can easily spend oodles of money when traveling. I mean, there's a whole industry just itching to get its fingers in your pockets and tell you it's worth it, it's life-changing, it's going to be the best thing you ever did. And like, maybe, but often maybe not too. So what are your good travel hacks? How do you travel for less?
I think the main thing is just going off season, first of all. and make the most of the travel special. So when I went to Hawaii, for example, a normal ticket to Hawaii is like $1,200 return. I paid $500 return. You know, I remember Air New Zealand had the special and it was between that date and that date. So that's when I went because I could. For the price of whatever you would go on a normal airfare, I went and I spent 11 days and I didn't spend $1,000 in 11 days, including airfares, accommodation, food, everything. I stay in hostels. That's probably not for everyone. Sometimes I will drag my tent across the world and I'll wild camp. I'll stay in campgrounds. I'm happy. I don't do it to save money. I mean, of course it helps, but I also enjoy, not all the time. I haven't gone the van life yet, but I could. But the biggest one is just going off season. And if you can't put up with sleeping with 12 other people in a room, then yeah, just go hustling.
I love off season travel as well. Can I just say, like, a lot of off season travel, A, you've cut down massively on the crowds. B, everything else that you do there is probably cheaper too. And also, I don't know if this is just like I've been really lucky, but every time I've done off-season travel, you know, the shoulder season is the classic. If you look for, you can find, you know, Google wherever you're wanting to go and then shoulder season, and you'll often find dates for when's the classic on that. I find the weather is usually better then too. It's not too hot, not too cold in most situations. I don't know. I'm such a fan of the off-season travel. Such a hack.
Oh, it is. And like I mentioned before, I'm not a big fan of eating out, for example. So I'll eat at the supermarket. I'll go to the supermarket. That's where I buy my food. I'll buy my beer at the supermarket as well. Like I don't go to bars and pubs and restaurants and that, because not because I don't think I should, it's just because I don't necessarily like it as much. And, you know, I take public transport and, you know, I travel by train and I take the buses and I walk a lot. So yeah, there's many ways of cutting costs. And of course, I mean, I travel by myself. If you travel with someone else with kids, it's a completely different trip.
Yeah. And the things you mentioned there as well, you know, going to a supermarket, walking around lots, taking public transport. I also think those are other underrated ways to get properly under the skin of wherever you're going. I mean, those are all things that I love as well. And especially using public transport is brilliant when I cannot be bothered trying to figure out road rules in a new country. That sounds like a great way to have a bad time and maybe an accident. Not for me. But, you know, the eating at the supermarket, public transport, walking around places, you really do have different experiences. You get more of the ambiance of a place. You interact with people in a different way. You see how other people live their actual lives. The people who live there aren't going to bars and restaurants every evening. Who can afford that when you're just in your daily life? They're going to the supermarket and you'll see different foods and you'll see different things around. I mean, you mentioned Hawaii. I remember being really struck, such a small thing, really struck by how they would have these arrays of the hard liquor in the Hawaiian supermarkets, because of course you don't do that in New Zealand. It's beer and wine only. And I just remember being really struck by that very small cultural difference. But you don't see those things if you don't go where average people are living their average lives. It's a frugal hack, but it's also a travel hack, I feel.
Oh, it definitely is. And you know, mentioning Hawaii, the bus system in Honolulu is amazing. It's so good. It goes everywhere. And the other thing too, like when you combine the volunteering, that's something I should bring it up. Like I was in Germany, your accreditation for when you're a volunteer on those big events, your accreditation gives you free public transport in the city or in the region you're at. So I got to go to so many little German villages and little towns nearby, you know, on the days that I was in Rosedon, which I had quite a lot this time around. And, oh, I just explored that region quite extensively, which was great. All free, like because of my accreditation, of course. I mean, I gave a lot of my time to the tournament and all of that kind of stuff. You know, just going to Bondi, you catch a bus, like, you know, it's $4, $5, $6 or something. That's, you know, that's my dinner in the supermarket most days.
Perfect. Perfect. Well, I've got to say, like, I really love what you've built here. I think the flexibility, the freedom, the travel, it's just so interesting. The lifestyle that you've built up, it's so unique. And I just think it's great that you figured out earlier on in life than a lot of people do that those are the things that you valued. If someone wanted to start building financial independence in a similar way to what you've done, where do you think they should start?
I think they should start by knowing their numbers. That's probably the main thing. And without being too patronizing, but, you know, just spend less than you earn. I think that's, which unfortunately.
I know, people hate hearing it, but it is true. It's the building blocks.
Of course, because I have friends that they ask me all the time, oh my God, I want to do what you do. And then when I tell them what I've done and they say, oh no, but I don't want to do that. So,
well, that is the price of entry. How much do you want? I often say this, right? It's like, do you want the end result or you're going to be living the journey so much, right? So if you want it bad enough, you'll do the things that get you there. If you don't want to do the things that get you there, you don't want it bad enough.
Oh, of course. I mean, it's a process and you've got to have your priorities and you've got to establish your boundaries and what you're willing to do and what you're not willing to do. But bear in mind, like, I not necessarily know what I want. I still probably don't. I just take every year as it comes. One thing I know is a lot of the times you just got to know what you don't want as well. So you can eliminate what you don't want and then let everything else unfold in front of you. And then just go with the wind. But you need to have that buffer. You need to have that backup to be able to, you know, to go with the flow. And, you know, it's not, you can't just do that out of a whim, of course. Like, you need to have some sort of foundations established.
Yeah, 100%. What do you think is the biggest factor that helped you get to where you are now?
I mean, I'm reasonably frugal. I live a simple life. So that, of course, helps. I don't spend a lot as it is. And I'm really good with numbers. I can do maths or I can get to ballparks just in my head quite easily. Sometimes it helps to spot a bad deal from a good deal. It's not that I understand a lot of how the game is played, but I have a really, you know, overview of it. So it helps me play the game a bit better. And, you know, once again, the podcast, the books that I've read, and that also helped. That just the way of thinking, it just opens up a whole new world. Like, that's what I felt it did for me. And all the books from the library, too. You don't need to spend a lot of money. Like, go to your local library. It's really great.
Yeah. And do you know what I've found is I'm, you know, obviously a podcast addict, and it's how I first got into podcasting is I was listening to overseas podcasts and was like, at that point, there were no New Zealand money podcasts. And I was just like, I really want this. I guess I'll just make it. But what I love about things like, you know, hitting up the library, getting the books, having a podcast that drops something every week or whatever, is you get that regular drip of motivation. And I think especially when you're starting something, you know, it gets easier as you go. You're always going to need motivation, but you're going to need more of it when you're trying to make a change or start on something. And having something in your ears every week or even every day, depending on how many you're listening to, it really helps you stay in the mindset of, yeah, this is what matters to me. This is what I'm focused on. Because there's so much noise in the rest of life, right? That can really get in your head and distract you, I think.
There is this great guy called Jerry Colonna, and it was on Tim Ferriss' podcast. And he said, how am I complicit in creating the conditions I say I don't want? And a lot of the time, you know, you dig your own holes inadvertently or inadvertently, you do it. And sometimes you just got to stop and look back and, you know, look inside and see what have I been doing that is actually going against me. And that got me thinking for a number of months, probably years. And I still, you know, I still have that line written down everywhere because I love it. I love it so much.
I think that line's going to stay with me now, too. That's a cracker of a line. I'm going to be spending the rest of our conversation with that just like rotating in my head.
a lot of living hacks, I should say.
Well, that's the whole point, right? I mean, look what you've done with your money is you've created a lifestyle from it. It's the old thing. Money itself, not important. It just impacts everything else that it is, right? So listening to people from all sorts of walks of life can give you ideas of how you might want to change one to influence the other. Speaking of, you know, being complicit in the lifestyles that we don't want, have there been any setbacks along your journey? Is there anything that anyone who's listening to this should avoid if they're wanting to build this financially flexible freedom lifestyle?
Sometimes you want to work and you can't find something straight away because your CV becomes quite patchy and you come across as flaky to a lot of employers, and a lot of people don't want to take you on because they think you're just going to leave and stuff. But little do they know that you can be the best employee sometimes because you're not there for money. You're there because you want to be there. You want to do what they're offering. And so that's probably one of the biggest setbacks is, you know, sometimes I want to work at places and I just can't get in. Or I have a 2-month trip coming up in the next 3 months and I usually disclose it. I'm open and I've missed out on jobs because of it.
How do you balance that? What sort of work do you end up doing? Because you do have a very varied work history, right? Do you just end up when you're like, okay, it's time for me to earn something, get out there, meet people in the workplace, get a little extra cash coming in? Do you target specific industries or types of work? Like, how do you make that work?
Well, when I left the dairy industry and I started moving to the South Island, like I had a little pit stop in, because I just fresh off production. So I managed to get myself into a vintage in a big winery. So that was really good. It's 2 months hard out work. And, you know, you learn a lot, you work a lot, but you make good money because you're doing like massive hours. And when I got to Christchurch, like I tried to get back into production, but like the money wasn't as good. So I thought, man, I don't want to be in a place that I don't want to be to make, you know, crappy money. So if I'm going to make crappy money, I want to be doing what I want.
Yeah, fair.
So at first I actually signed up with a temp agency and then I got a couple of jobs through it. And then I ended up getting another job at a big warehouse and I enjoyed that. It's just like, I haven't really targeted anything. It's just a matter of, I was looking at the hours, but that was at the beginning. Like, and now that I moved to Queenstown, I've kind of gone to hospitality, of course, and gone to retail hospitality kind of situation because that's what it's available here. And they do take a lot of casuals. They do take a lot of casual workers here and seasonal workers because that's the nature of the city. I just fit in. The only difference is that I'm not on a working holiday visa. I'm a permanent resident. So
I love it. Just giving it a crack and building up all these different life experiences, whether that's travel or work related. Look, what's next for you? Are you thinking more travel? Do you have different financial goals? What's next on the horizon?
No, financially wise, I've decided it's enough what I have. Every year I don't touch my buffer. I see what happens next year. I'm really not putting too much thought into it. Yeah, I could get another $1 million, $2 million, whatever. That would be great. I mean, I'm not saying it's not good, but I don't need $1 million. I don't need $500,000. I need way less than that. And that still kind of keeps me afloat and not with the water up to here. You know, like I'm comfortably afloat. And then you get the odd jobs here and there. I think next is just try to get another casual job and figuring out what I'm going to do next summer, if I'm going to get another full-time job for the summer again or if I'm going to try to do something else. I really don't know. I have the volleyball tournament in Adelaide in November that I'm hoping to volunteer at. That's the only thing I kind of have on at the moment.
That sounds amazing. I love the flexibility and the freedom that you've built. And I think you've built it so much earlier through life than so many people do. So that's brilliant. It really speaks volumes towards deciding on your values and just hit and go on them. Thank you so much. That's Germano Gomez telling us all about his financially independent, financially free lifestyle. It's great. Now, if this episode was helpful to you, do hit subscribe wherever you're watching or listening. More importantly, send it to a friend so we can all be inspired about the different things we could do with our money and the ways it can create a life that we actually love. Until next time, have a great day.
Just a note before you go. This podcast can only give you general information about how things work in most cases. It's not individual financial advice. We're all different, so some of this might not apply to your specific situation. Take what works for you, ignore the rest. If you're after individual financial advice, a financial advisor is always the best bet.